Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in History. This is your host, Bob Wintermute. In this episode of the New Books in Military History podcast, I'm coming to you from Bloomsfield College with our guest, Harry Frankie Rivera. I first must offer a disclosure. Harry and I go way back. We first met in 1998 in one of Russell Wiley's seminars on American military history at Temple University. Since then, Harry went on to finish a master's degree at Temple, then his doctorate in history at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. More recently, Harry's become probably the leading scholar on the military history and culture of Puerto Rico. Indeed, his recent book, Soldiers of the Nation, Military Service in Modern Puerto Rico, 1868 to 1952, is the subject of our talk today. A vocal advocate for Puerto Rican social and political concerns, Harry is also a 10-year veteran of the United States Army and National Guard. Harry, it's great to chat with you here on New Books in Military History.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Yeah. Hey, I've known you for a long time, and I've been following your career with no small interest. Can you share with our listeners what motivated you to pursue this project? If I'm not mistaken, you've been interested in the military history of Puerto Rico for a very long time, correct?
Yes, that is correct. To a certain point, this all started when I was getting ready to move to Philadelphia to start my master's degree in military history at Temple. And a few days before I left Puerto Rico, my future mother-in-law, she gave me a news article, an in-depth article about this woman, Noemi Figueroa Sulet, who had started to investigate the experience of the 65th Infantry in Korea and was interested in eventually making a documentary. So that caught my attention, but the way history had always been for me is that nothing had ever happened in Puerto Rico. The Puerto Rican had no history, so I had always done European and United States history, and that's what I wanted to do at Temple, and little by little, that what I read in that newspaper kept, I don't know, waking me up at night. And I said, I need to research these people who went to Korea in 1950. I didn't even know I had transited on avenues named on their honor, never paying attention. I had seen the monuments all to Puerto Rico, like hidden in plain sight. But no one, they had been forgotten. So I decided to back at Temple to research them and write my master thesis on them. And something interesting happened is that I thought I was going to write a traditional military history of how many they were, where they sent, where did they fight, accolades, coming back, wrap up the war. But then I started to interview the veterans, and they started telling me these stories in which they were fighting both for the United States and Puerto Rico, and of course the economic part of it. We were so poor in World War II. We joined World War II for the first time, but in Korea it was different. I mean, they're fighting, they're dying, they keep volunteering, and you start seeing these pictures of them raising Puerto Rican flags and reading parts of the new constitution. And then I realized that this war was in many ways the first global and total war for Puerto Ricans. And in many ways, it was a war of emancipation and decolonization. And I thought, okay, I'm going to finish, had to graduate. So this is going to be about the military matters. But when I go into a PhD program, I had to go all the way back to study how military history or military participation of the people of Puerto Rico in different armed forces under Spain and under the United States had shaped socioeconomic and cultural and political projects in Puerto Rico. And that's where the books, that's from where the book comes from.
That's great. Wow. You know, there appear to be, for me, two overarching themes to the book. First, the story of military service has been central to the Puerto Rican pursuit of identity, you know, inside their own quest for legitimacy and acceptance as members, you know, and indeed citizens, I guess, denied full participation within the American experience. And second, that the path towards modernization for Puerto Rico is tied irrevocably to the American military. Do you want to comment on that?
Those are exactly two of the main points that I tried to explore and get across in the book. The first one, yes, military service has been instrumental in shaping modern Puerto Rican's identities. And that is why I polarized my book between 1868 and 1952, because I think that the events that take place in 1868 when Puerto Ricans state the biggest revolt against Spanish sovereignty in Puerto Rico and 1952 when the current status are created, they show these 9+ decades. It shows a century in which military service is at the forefront of who are the Puerto Ricans and who are they going to be. For example, 1868, it is the Puerto Rican militias who put down the insurrection, doing Spain a huge favor. But Spain is so, it worries that this Puerto Rican militiamen may become the nucleus of a rebel army, and they decide to demobilize the Puerto Ricans at that point. And in Puerto Rican historiography, they say the accepted narrative, or most common narrative, is that the local elite, known as criollo, little by little, were excluded from the colonial bureaucracy, and that created a big schism with the new Spanish newcomers and kind of fueled the idea of independence or that we're different, right? I argue that they were not that excluded, right? But that the big exclusion, the big sign saying you're not like us and you will never be, it's when the able male population to serve in the military is excluded and is told no.
We're talking about the creolized elites or the peasant, I hate to use
the word, the criollo elites.
Yeah.
The criollo elites within Puerto Rico and the Spanish Caribbean, criollo is a claim to whiteness in many ways. So the criollo elites, they were not excluded. They needed Spain as their support. But what created that sense of we're Puerto Ricans and they're Spaniards, is that the Puerto Rican, those born in Puerto Rico, could no longer serve in the militia, which is in many ways emasculates the population in Puerto Rico. And so that's part of it, right? What happens, and then like I explained in the book, the United States comes with a total different mentality. No, we're going to use the military to create a new Puerto Rican. And eventually that, starting World War I, that process of creating a new Puerto Rican identities, a new Puerto Rican man, fall into the hands of the criollos, right? Especially after the National Guard is formed. And by World War II, that process, creating a new Puerto Rican via military service, start to become popularized or to fall in the hands of the public. And by the Korean War, what we have is that the politicians creating a state that can accommodate complex modern Puerto Rican identities are responding to the knees of those soldiers. So, so it is that whole century, and I'm trying to, you know, that we're historians, we create centuries that don't have to be chronologically. I want this to be a century in Puerto Rico, the century of Puerto Rican identities and how they are contested, or the century over the fight over modern Puerto Rico.
You know, it's interesting that we're putting this in the context of a struggle for identity within the identity itself. I can't help but think that what you're doing, you know, you're placing military service as being central to national identity. You know, anybody who's read Eugene Weber's books, Peasants and the Frenchman and other works, you know, won't disagree with that. But it also seems to run contrary to what has passed for the last 40 years as acceptable scholarship of Puerto Rican identity, which has seemed to be, I'm not going to go so far as to call it anti-military, but very military skeptic.
That's another big part of the book that I took the time to debunk accepted scholarship on Puerto Rico and the role of the military, starting with the myth of Puerto Ricans being granted U.S. citizenship so they could go into World War One, which is basically, I don't even know how it became part of the accepted scholar narrative. To be honest, it was part of my, when I grew up, it was like it was embedded in my DNA. Mm-hmm. That was one of my truths.
Right.
And the first time you start to research, even the most superficial research starts showing you, oh, no, first of all, you didn't need to be a citizen to have to register for the draft. This has been a process in the making way before, since at least in 1902, the process has started. And then when you see that the draft, the Puerto Ricans were excluded from the draft and they felt insulted and demanded that they would be included. And that was just one of them. There were so many myths. And what I came to realize is that perhaps maybe of the anti-military history backlash after Vietnam, that military topics became taboo. No one really researched them. And
it was also about the question of Puerto Rican independence was never really questioned at that time either, in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That scholarship.
No, definitely. I mean, independence, there were group pro-independence, but they were small and weak. And actually, that period, World War One, even the most staunchly pro-independence Puerto Ricans, they supported the war effort, participated mm-hmm. in the war, because the war has been sold as a war to end all wars. Mm-hmm. And how could they stay out of it, right? Mm-hmm. So there's no, basically, there's no opposition to the war in Puerto Rico, not even from the most staunchly pro-independence leader who say, yeah, we have to participate in this war and we're going to have to wear a U.S. Army uniform, but that's fine. That's fine. Mm. So, yeah, definitely counters it counters many narratives that have become accepted truism in Puerto Rican historiography, but that unfortunately they didn't have a leg to stand on.
Mm. You know, we've spoken about the role of the Criollas in the 1868 rebellion. And of course, they're going to be a feature going forward. That's a very small sector of the population, obviously. A much larger, you know, peasant population, the Jibaro, or Jibaro, mm-hmm. I hope I'm pronouncing it
the
right.
Jibaro, yeah.
The Jibaro. They're a different community entirely. How do they identify themselves as being part of this project?
Well, the Criollos are interesting because a way of them to claim legitimacy as the people who should be the rulers of Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. as opposed to a Spaniard newcomer. Mm-hmm. And there's very little difference between the Criollos and the newcomers from Spain, is to look at the Jíbaro the same way that some paternalistic army officer are going to look at Native American mm-hmm. and say, well, I can kill the Jíbaro and create a new man out of it. And if I cannot do it by putting them to processes or institutions, at least I can write and create an idea of a jíbaro, of a jíbaro or a Puerto Rican peasant that looks more like I do. And that begins the whitening of the Puerto Rican peasant. So it looks, at least in cultural literary production, more like the criollo elites, who are also oppressors in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, wait a minute. I mean, I've studied colonial systems in the United States. And of course, I look at these questions of racial intermingling and transformation and the American perspective at the same time. The last thing you wanted to do as a good, you know, white American was to countenance the whitening of, you know, different groups. It'd be the American Indians, African Americans, Mexican Americans. They were distinct and separate.
Yeah.
They were going to change us. But here in Puerto Rico, you're saying it was the exact opposite. We were going to change them through the same kind of process.
Yes, and Puerto Rico is interesting because you have parallels, parallel process to those occurring in the United States, but those occurring in the Caribbean, Central America, and South America. And there are several processes of the whitening, right?
Yeah.
In which most of the Puerto Rican peasantry is of very mixed ancestry.
Sure.
The way it's going to be presented at the end, it is like basically a family that just came from Switzerland. They look that way. But when you put your troops on the ground, you look at the people saying, no, they don't look like a peasant family from a farmer from Switzerland. No, they don't look like that, right? So why do they do this? Because it's a way of gaining respectability. The Spanish Caribbean live under the spectrum of there's going to be racial war. If you become independent, you're going to become Haiti.
Haiti's always in the background. Yeah.
And in all the different Caribbeans, people try to escape what is perceived as blackness and whiten themselves and the populations that they wish to command. So that's why the whitening of the peasantry starts with the elites writing about basically this white peasant families who are rustic and humble, but they're also pure, and they're kind of like us, they look like us, and we should command them and turn them into something better if we can.
Wow. We talked briefly about the Lares Rebellion of 1868, and of course you described how, you know, the militia was banned, or disbanded, rather, after the rebellion. They were too successful. There's a clear implication of what that's going to mean in 1898. The absence of a militia means there's going to be no military response of note to American invasion. Does that necessarily translate then into the rise of a pro-American sentiment within the Creoles?
Well, this is interesting because if in 68 they demobilized the Puerto Rican militia that had kept Puerto Rico Spanish for 300 plus years, almost immediately what they do, they have this corps of volunteers, which is reserved for newcomers from Spain and their children. It becomes another mean of coercion, and is reserved for the most pro-Spanish elements in Puerto Rico, right? And eventually, because of the war going on in Cuba in 1895-98, Puerto Ricans come to serve again in the Spanish military. But again, they're looking, the way they put it, they basically force Puerto Ricans to show their card, like how much pro-Spain you have been. Like you have to prove it. It's like a proof of blood, but a historical proof of how much pro-Spain your family has been, to make sure that if we accept you into our military, you're going to fight even harder than Spaniards themselves for us to win, because if we lose, you're the one who loses it the more, right? The most. So when the United States is about to invade Puerto Rico, when the Spanish War, the Público Spanish-American War start, and mayors in Puerto Rico start to receive letters of groups of Puerto Ricans who want to volunteered to create a militia to assist the Spaniards, but the Spanish authorities say, no, thank you, this is the last thing we want. We cannot trust these people, mm-hmm. right? They're using the Corps of Volunteers, which is this elite part of the Peninsulares and their children, to assist the regular Spanish garrison. And what happened is that as soon or even days before the United States invaded, Puerto Ricans band called seditious parties, they start to form. They mm-hmm. start stealing horses. Then they become kind of like a ad hoc infantry, cavalry on their own, and they start to harass the Corps of Volunteers and the Spanish forces behind their own lines, right?
Yeah.
Within the lines, because they're all over, which forces the Corps of Volunteers that they have been put in advanced position to support the Spanish military to say, I have to go. They're burning my hacienda, mm. right? So when the Americans invaded, the Puerto Ricans have already started these parties to harass the Spanish forces and their paramilitary or reserve force, the Corps of Volunteers. Mm-hmm. So that is already happening. So this made that there was no war in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
No, as soon as the war started, shortly before the United States invaded, the Spanish forces were being harassed by Puerto Rican. And when the Americans invaded, then it was mm-hmm. even worse for the Spaniards. And that helped the Americans advance so quickly.
Step back just a short bit. You know, we're talking about the American invasion now, and you place the island within the larger strategy that the United States had for securing the Caribbean. You know, it's a standard narrative, you know, that shows Puerto Rico as like being secondary consideration. You know, everything's all into Cuba. Despite Nelson Miles, the commanding general of the army, saying, no, we should go to Puerto Rico first because of the sickly season in Cuba. He's overridden by the War Department. They land at Daiquiri, whatnot. Which leads some to argue, and it's a long buildup, leads some to argue that the invasion of Puerto Rico was unnecessary. How do you come down on that?
Well, Puerto Rico may have been a secondary target in the way the war was to be conducted, mm-hmm. that is fine, and I completely agree with you, and it wasn't necessary to invade Puerto Rico to end the war. The Spaniards have been trying to end the war diplomatically mm-hmm. since before the Americans landed at Daiquiri. They've been mm-hmm. trying to find a peaceful solution, but in all their diplomatic correspondence, they say, we want to keep Puerto Rico. And the United States keeps saying, no.
Mm.
And that is why about a week after Cuba, the Cuban garrison surrenders, mm-hmm. And the Spaniards have continued to say, let's end this war. We're ready to end this war. Mm-hmm. You don't have to come here. Can we keep Puerto Rico? And the United States keeps saying, no. Theodore Roosevelt writes to Henry Cabot Lodge, the famous telegram, don't make peace until we take Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. And Puerto Rico is invaded, so there's boots on the ground, and Puerto Rico can be claimed.
So it is necessary then. It's yeah. not that it's unnecessary. The campaign yeah. does have a purpose.
Yeah, it's necessary. I mean, they could have ended the war without it, but right. the idea is if we had troops on the ground, mm-hmm. then they have to give up Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. And Puerto Rico is ceded in lieu of indemnities, mm-hmm. right? So it's not necessary to end the war, but it's necessary to attain the goals of the war, which is to secure Puerto Rico for the to protect access to Central America and the Proyecto Interoceanic Canal. Mm-hmm. And Mahan is writing about this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We're going to come to Mahan in a moment. Yeah. I mean, the campaign itself, gratefully, is very brief, almost bloodless. There are a few casualties.
Very few.
But almost bloodless. You've described, of course, how the Criollo volunteers responded to the war. They become, you know, almost auxiliaries fighting with the Americans. What about the rest of the island? How do they take to this sudden transfer?
Well, I want to say this. It's not the Criollos, which are part of the lead, they, until the end, they were swearing the loyalty to Spain, but as soon as the American landed, they started to defect. Right. It is the Puerto Rican peasantry and the common Puerto Rican who are, before even before the Americans landed, who are already taking things into their own hands, right?
Okay, yeah.
So how have people reacted? Well, Spain had not been a good administrator or even an administrator to Puerto Rico. So as soon as the Americans landed, they started to be joined by some of these parties, right? Mm-hmm. By local people, by sometimes they will be received, and there will be a certain occasion which the resident of the town were already raising the American flag in one of these cases backwards because they didn't know how, they never seen one before. They just got a hold of one. And but it was the resentment against Spain. The fact that the American campaign was fought in what I call a hearts and mind campaign, that mild decided, no, I'm not gonna advance. I'm not gonna advance with the support of the naval guns because that is going to create unnecessary destruction. Mm-hmm. I'm just gonna take a different approach and let the people come to me. So he's not interested in alienating the Puerto Rico, but getting the Puerto Ricans to side with him. And that's what happened. And that, I mean, they had started fighting on their own. And the Americans came with Puerto Rican scouts and Puerto Rican influentials who have been living in exile in the United States.
Yeah, I was going to say, just as there was a Cuban exile community, there was a Puerto Rican community as well.
Yeah, and they arrived with the American invasion and they knew where to go. And the Puerto Rican campaign was, as you say, pretty bloodless, in great part because Puerto Rico, and this I find out talking to a friend who is working on Puerto Rico as a testing ground for Spanish military new technologies, right? I mean, it has been used as an infirmary, as a staging area, the war of reconquest, the war for Cuba. And his theory is that the Spanish troops in Puerto Rico had some of the best, most modern equipment the Spanish military had because they were trying everything in Puerto Rico before deploying in Cuba. And they had a plan of going back to a defensive line until they would actually mount a strong resistance. But that huge fight in which, in the way of seeing it, the Spaniards were doing kind of like an elastic defense, letting the Americans advance, and then let go of the rubber band. But the rubber band never snapped because the surrender came before the big battles.
You mentioned Captain Alfred Thayer Mahan earlier, and you give a lot of credit to him for the inevitable annexation of Puerto Rico as a dependency of the United States. What was Mahan's outlook towards the people of the island?
I don't think that he was I don't think he ever saw who the people of the island were, like many people who supported the war in Cuba because of what the yellow press presented, a damsel in distress, a white damsel in distress abused by a dark Spaniard. Mm-hmm. And when they go to Cuba, I say, wow, these people are darker than the darker Spaniard abusing them. I don't know what we're going to do with them, right?
Right.
So Mahan actually talks about the Philippines, Puerto Rico, and Cuba in a book called Lesson of the War with Spain. His message, and I'm summarizing here, his thoughts are like, basically, we need these places. These people are kind of the unholy mix of Indian, Black, and Spaniard, and on top of that, they had Catholicism. They're too compromised racial, race-wise and culture-wise. But we should follow the paternal approach of the British and try to make something out of them. So we're going to rule their lands and we're going to make them better. That's what we're going to give them. So it's Mahan, without saying it explicitly, he's talking about civilizational imperialism.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
We need these people. They should not become part of us because it's going to be horrible for us. But we should try to civilize them. And we need those places.
And that's that competing vision of whiteness again that I mentioned earlier. The American view of whiteness versus the Spanish or Puerto Rican view. How do his views towards Puerto Rico then fit into the larger Mahanian strategy?
Into the how does the view for Puerto Rico fit into the his larger view?
Yeah.
Well, I think that something interesting about Maham is that in his late stage production, he started to include race as a factor for military strategy. So I know I just mentioned this already, but we need the place. We don't like the people, but we should rule them in the most benevolent of ways, just like the British do, and try to civilize and kind of repay them for using their base, right? And then I found other writing from Mahan about the canal and promoting the canal, what the canal is going to do. And he talks and he said, it's not only going to allow us to have a military presence and concentrate our naval forces in the ocean that we need them rapidly, right? This is something that comes from 1898 as they send reinforcement from the Pacific Squadron to the Caribbean, and it takes almost 2 months to reach the fight, right? Mm-hmm. That's unacceptable. So he say it's not only good for the Navy and for protecting the sea, the trade routes, but it's going to allow us to populate the West Coast with desirable people as opposed to the undesirable now setting in that area. Mm-hmm. It's going to keep the United States. It's going to protect the fabric that makes the American. And he started writing about that in his later writing. It's all about how do we keep them out. And to him, the Panama Canal for trade, military purposes, yeah. And on top of that, your cherry on top is it's going to allow us to bring the rice European stock and populate the Western coast.
Right. Interesting. You know, I've written to some small extent myself on the nature of American imperial administration in the Caribbean, you know, particularly through the lens of tropical health or tropicality and public health. You know, and reading your book, I keep thinking back to the influence of medical officers like Bailey K. Ashford, William Crawford Gorgas in framing Puerto Rico and its inhabitants. You know, I recall that Gorgas went on about the hazards of tropical islands like Puerto Rico to American whiteness. And he went so far as to proclaim that the island was, in his word, I remember this quote vividly, not being fit for white men until the scourge of insect vector disease was dealt with. And Ashford, of course, we know, went on to become the heroic figure who treated hookworm infection in Puerto Rico. These guys viewed Puerto Rico as a laboratory for their work. How did Puerto Ricans view their work and these men themselves? Were they accepted?
Well, I think Bailey is one of these figures that he was native. He married into the Puerto Rican medical class. He married a Puerto Rican woman. Mm-hmm. He came to love the place. I know you read his autobiography.
Yeah.
And of course, he's using the language of the time, but he fell in love with the island. I think he was more than... Sorry?
No, I was going to say, that's so interesting because he goes on, when he's serving in China in the 20s, he becomes like the expert on going native. And, you know, how do we prevent American soldiers in the Philippines and in China from going Asiatic?
Yeah.
And, you know, they're medicalizing this fear of losing whiteness.
Yeah.
And yet, he becomes a part of that himself. I love this. I mean, that's just...
No, he completely become part of it. And, the first school for the study of tropical diseases is named on his honor in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first one set up by the military. But I think that he was, distrusted by the peasantry.
Mm-hmm.
But as they start to see the results, that they no longer have the hook wound, that they feel better, that people that were in the brink of death, and all of a sudden they come back to their town healthy and say, oh, this doctor is Dr. Ashford. So I think at first distrusted, then completely accepted. They ran these clinics for years and they treated hundreds of thousands of patients, the people who needed it the most. Mm-hmm. And
Jibaro patients too, not the Criollos.
Yeah, it was mostly Jibaro that had been the medical establishment in Puerto Rico had seen them. They say, this is endemic. There's no cure for this. And the cure was less than a cent to, it cost less than a cent per patient to cure them. And Bailey K. Ashford, he says, this is a disposable labor force. That's what they're not interested in curing them. They die when they're about 32, 35, and they're replaced by their kids. And he sees this as a type of modern day slavery in which your labor is stuck and it's replaced. It never ends. And I say, no, this is unacceptable. So eventually, the people opposing him, it's not the peasantry. Mm-hmm. It's the people interested in perpetuating the system.
Right.
And one thing that I argue that is because of this type of initiative that very early in Puerto Rico, a special relationship between the peasantry and the army starts to develop. And that's not the first thing that Ashford did. He was the medical officer. I think it's called Castillo or Castle Serrayes. And a hurricane came to Puerto Rico a few months after they were there. And something happened that the peasantry had never seen. Instead of closing the gates of the castle, the military opened it up for the Puerto Rican peasantry. And they didn't know what to do. Come inside. There's a hurricane coming. And then it's the military for the good part of a year, feeding the population.
Yeah.
So they had never seen this. Spain had never done this. It had always left Puerto Rico on its own in time of crisis and imposed even bigger, higher taxes. And it would be individual private citizens who would do all these things that Spain as a state, as a colonial state, always failed to do and to deliver. So that's why I started to create this special relationship with the bulk of the population, and in particular the peasantry, and I would say the military, I would say the U.S. Army, because with the Navy, that's another story.
Sure, sure.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, then Gorgas, though, is on the other side of that, because he doesn't display the same kind of benevolent paternalism that Ashford does. He's also a medical officer. Gorgas was, he's responsible for eliminating yellow fever in Cuba and Guayaquil in Ecuador and the Panama Canal Zone, but always saying, I'm doing this to make the place fit for white settlement. How did that play out?
Well, like I say, some of them that we are discussing, some of them did it for some reason. Ashford, he called himself a soldier in science. He was more interested in solving problems. He, like you mentioned, he was like the ultimate going native officer. So I think those who worked with him and follow his pattern, his behavior, his process, they were accepted. Those others like Gorgas, with their idea that we're making this safer for us, well, the big question should be here, how much of that does the population get to know, right? Because it's not like, to put it this way, Ashford, he goes and he talks with the population. He's in the mid, right? They sing his word, right? So Gorgas, I don't know how he conducted, I don't know how much he was in the field, and his private papers, they're not available to the presentry, right? That's what we know now. So I don't know how it would be, how the two of them would be perceived differently because of their personal approaches of what drives them.
Right.
I think people at that time, they would care more about the results they're seeing.
Sure, sure.
Right, because if someone cures, let's say that your daughter or your son, daughter or son are dying, right? Mm-hmm. And then come this doctor. And next day, they're fine. Are you going to worry about, I wonder why they're curing people here? Yeah. No, that's something that we do now.
Yeah.
Right? They're going to be, from my view, I'm going to be walking home again barefoot and stepping in the same feces, getting reinfected, but thinking, wow, this guy saved my children.
Mm-hmm. It's a powerful incentive indeed. Yeah. Let's skip ahead a bit. I don't want to get too bogged down in the immediate colonial period. We may come back to some questions there. What was the Jones Act about?
The Jones Act, the one in 1917? Well, for starting in 1901, 1902, the big question with what to do with Puerto Rico became, should they be citizens? Mm-hmm. What's going on in Puerto Rico? So in 1900, you had the Foraker Act that made Puerto Ricans American nationals and Puerto Rican citizens. Mm-hmm. Which is a citizenship that had no value but just inside Puerto Rico. They weren't any Puerto Rican passports, meaning that the only place that which Puerto Rican could travel was American possessions, right? Mm-hmm. So they created that. This is Congress deciding who are the Puerto Rican politically and legally, right? Mm-hmm. So that also created the first civilian government. Then Puerto Rican felt that, hey, this is not enough. We thought we were going to become a territory and then set up the union eventually or independent. But what is this crazy thing? I mean, we're right in the middle, right? And no one is actually happy with the decision, but some people see it as a way, especially those pro-annexation and becoming a state of the union, say, no, this is one step, a different state than the state they usually take, but we are on our way to be citizens and a state. Don't worry. By 1914, there's a heated debate, like, no, this is unacceptable. And for the first time, actually, 1912, 1913, there's a huge debate, and the pro-independence faction start growing. There's so much discontent in Puerto Rico, so the United States retakes the question, what do we do with Puerto Rico and the Puerto Ricans? And at that point, 1914, Woodrow Wilson comes into the picture. He appoints Governor Yeager, and all of them agree in their interesting worldview that we need Puerto Rico, but we should not have a colony, so we need to make them citizens. Mm-hmm. And this is something that Theodore Roosevelt had been advocating since 1900. He's like, we need to give them citizenship. They deserve citizenship, right? Mm-hmm. But the military is opposed. Basically, everyone in the United States is opposed to citizenship. And in 1914, Wilson started pushing way before World War I started. Mm-hmm. Actually, he campaigned on that. 1912, 1913, he's already talking about that. Yeager is talking about Puerto Rican citizenship for the Puerto Rico in 1912, 1913. That's one of the reasons that his friend Wilson appointed him governor of Puerto Rico. For coming to Puerto Rico, he writes a big essay that this is how we culminate our democratic experiment in Puerto Rico. And well, it turned out that the military wasn't ready. They say, well, individually, some Puerto Ricans had demonstrated they're modern enough and manly enough, but collectively, no. So we support in independent, individual-based citizenship, seeing everyone case by case. Or those who are well-educated, those who have property may qualify
for citizenship. Those who are white may qualify for citizenship.
And educated and rich.
Yes.
So it doesn't go anywhere, but Wilson keeps pushing. Mm-hmm. And then World War I starts, and you know that he tried his diplomacy.
Right.
To end the war diplomatically, but to end... One of his main goals is to end the colonial empire, self-determination and whatnot. And everyone can look at him, and actually people are looking at him from Latin America and from Europe. Seriously, you want to end colonial empires? Have you looked at yourself? What about Cuba, Philippines, and Puerto Rico? So he goes to Congress in 1915, I think December 1915, and he calls Congress because they haven't given Puerto Rican citizenship, and he says the war is watching. They want to know that we're serious about ending colonies, mm-hmm. because in his mind, giving citizenship to the Puerto Rican and the colonial, and the Puerto Rican, and the United States, the American colonial empire, Puerto Rico will no longer be a colony. And he said, this is important for my diplomacy. Mm-hmm. I can end the war with this. And that is why the process to give Puerto Rican citizenship is accelerated way before mm-hmm. the United States is even involved in the war. It's right. not to send them because they're not wanted in the military at all.
Right, right. Well, how do the islands' elites respond to the exposure to the Jim Crow morality they observed during the war?
Well, this is interesting because when it was announced that the Puerto Rican division, their contribution to the National Army mm-hmm. was going to be segregated, there was so much outcry. Mm-hmm. But the outcry was hypocritical because Puerto Rico had its own de facto segregation already. Mm-hmm. And it had been the Puerto Rican militias were the white Puerto Ricans who served there mm-hmm. and Afro-Puerto Ricans served in different units. It had always been segregated.
Right.
So it was a way of saying, we're going to be segregated. You know that you and I are brother. Mm-hmm. Is that guy above us who is separating us?
Right.
But it was from my point of view, it was quite hypocritical. Mm-hmm. But then Afro-Puerto Rican leaders, political leaders, they took that and they linked the fight, they linked the struggle or what they thought it would be the struggle of the Puerto Rican color regiments. They say they're doing just like the Senegalese colonial troops and the African-American who are fighting. It's a war of liberation of the black race. And right. that's how they start presenting in Puerto Rico, Afro-Puerto Rican leaders.
Mm. Was there a sense, I mean, the Puerto Rican regiments don't serve in combat in the war. Was there a sense that they were not martial enough for the army, or was there another factor at play here?
Well, the military refused to accept Puerto Rican or to raise more Puerto Rican units. So Woodrow Wilson had to intervene right. after receiving letter after letter from Puerto Rican leaders. And I'm talking just political leaders, but I'm talking about community leaders.
Right.
Well-to-do Puerto Rican writing. This is an insult. The Puerto Rican legislature say we want to contribute, right? So at this point, there's the Puerto Rican regiment. The Puerto Rican mm-hmm. regiment is sent to Panama.
Yeah,
and the newspapers in particular say, wow, we were found fit enough to defend this important installation that allows for the projection of American power.
Yeah.
Wow, they trust us. No, they're sending them there because
they're out of harm's way.
They're out of harm's way. And the military, right, this way we free white troops mm-hmm. to do the real fighting. Mm-hmm. And as you probably know, the division that is raised in Puerto Rico, it encounters all kinds of obstacles from the American military because the War Department say, I don't want to train them. Mm-hmm. I don't want to equip them. And when they're forced to, they say, okay, we're going to train them and we're going to give them the same uniforms and the same weapons, but they will never leave the island. They will right. never see combat. And that they were almost ready to be deployed when the armistice came mm-hmm. happened. Despite the War Department, and it happened because Puerto Rican leaders, they said, you don't find land? Here, I'm going to donate my land so you can set up your training mm-hmm. camp. Oh, you're not finding ways of mobilizing people? Private individual mm-hmm. took on the task of getting the Puerto Rican to register, to get them fit, to pass the exam, mm-hmm. and the rejection rate is over 75%. Jeez. They just didn't want them.
Right.
And it's kind of just like the African Americans are doing, they're fighting for their right to fight. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, and when you look at the literature, is to prove our manhood and fitness for self-determination.
Moving forward to future mm-hmm. political considerations, obviously. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. What about mainland Puerto Ricans? How did they fit in? Because I know that there's Puerto Ricans who served, for example, in the 77th Division, the New York City Division. Mm-hmm. What kind of response are they getting from within the army or the American community?
Well, it's interesting that the Puerto Rican communities and Latino community there started to emerge, and they're really small, right? Mm-hmm. So what you get from the little bit that I've been able to recover from at the time called the Hispanic press, mm-hmm. Is that they would follow these soldiers just like, say, the Irish community would follow, mm-hmm. The Irish American community would follow their soldiers detached here and there. And it was, mm-hmm. today was a sense of claiming that we belong here.
Right.
I also found letters and news part in which the Puerto Rican in New York, chosen by the draft, his number is called. He said, but I'm not a citizen. Yeah. I'm like, well, yes, you are, but you don't need to be a citizen to serve your country.
And that's you and everybody else in this division.
Yeah. Right. And it is interesting that Puerto Ricans who were here, right, they would, if they were found to be white, and many of them were, mm-hmm. they would be sent to white units, and mm-hmm. they ended up fighting.
Right.
But most of them were sent to the 77, and many of them ended up fighting with the 369, mm-hmm. not just because they fit the profile, but because Gene Reese Europe went to Puerto Rico to recruit Puerto Rican musicians for his band. And,
right,
and,
right.
And that led to all kind of wonderful things for Puerto Rico, because this musician Rafael Hernandez, who is now at the maximum composer in Puerto Rican history, he adds to what he knows about music, that he's already a person who plays many instruments by ear, he can write whatnot. When mm-hmm. he under Reese Europe and being in France, he just grows exponentially, and after that he just right. become I mean, in Puerto Rico, everyone knows Rafael Hernandez, and his experience during the war that turned him mm-hmm. into the musician that he became for Puerto Rico.
It's remarkable. I've read that President Warren G. Harding supported the idea of Puerto Rican statehood. Is this serious? Is this real? Or was this fantasy? How seriously should we take that?
You mean citizenship or statehood?
Statehood.
A statehood. There have been, I'm not quite sure right now about Harding, but I think that he's in the list of presidents that actually support a statehood. And it is interesting that to this day, the statehood movement in Puerto Rico is associate with the, or identify with the Republican Party, because mm-hmm. the Republican Party had a long trajectory of supporting statehood
right.
for Puerto Rico. So that wasn't uncommon. Mm-hmm. It wasn't uncommon. There's a long list of Republicans and some Democrats who have expressed themselves in favor of statehood for Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, the 1930s were a tough time for the Isles. You know, so they were for the entire United States. And you described this was the time when Puerto Rico became America's Ireland. There's a lot packed into that description. Can you break it down? What do you mean?
Well, the title and the description for that chapter came from what some politicians or political leaders in the era were writing in the newspapers, and especially Luis Muñoz Marin, mm-hmm. he who was going to eventually become the first elected governor of the island and mm-hmm. creator of the Commonwealth formula the state of Puerto Rico has now. He's pro-independence at the time. He's a nationalist who is starting to flirt with and understand socialism, and that is going to be really important a decade later. Mm-hmm. Later, but when he's writing for the press, he's talking about the violence that is the political pressure that is accumulating in Puerto Rico, because we cannot continue under this socioeconomic and political conditions, right? Mm-hmm. So he just write it like that. Right. You're going to have an Ireland in the Caribbean.
Right.
An American Ireland, right? And it actually then come in the extreme nationalists, yeah. in which they have their leader had associated with the Sinn Féin and whatnot. They bring the tactics of the IRA to Puerto Rico.
Oh my goodness.
Bombs, assassinations, assassinated policemen, postal worker, because they represent
the state.
State. And imagine this. This always makes me think about the Civil War because of the postal service. Are we going to be able to deliver the mail? No. You represent the federal government, so I'm going to shoot you. So, and that is kind of like an interesting parallel. And they bring bombs, assassinations, even when it's discussed, it's being discussed in the Puerto Rican legislature to have an official Puerto Rican flag, the one that we have now.
Yeah.
The nationalists rush the legislature to stop that. No, that's our flag. You cannot use it. You represent, you're part of the colonial bureaucracy.
Mm.
So, and it became, it started with political tension and eventually becomes a shooting war between the Puerto Rican insular police led by American officers and the nationalists who create their military wings.
It's interesting that it doesn't draw in a greater American military response. Perhaps that's why, you know, I was surprised by the implications of that term when you presented it to us. I mean, it would have been perfectly good reason for the Marines to go to Puerto Rico or for the Army to go to Puerto Rico. I mean, they're already in Panama, Haiti, Nicaragua, Guatemala, and other places. How do we avoid militarizing that conflict?
The conflict didn't get to be militarized because the police was militarized enough.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as the nationalists raised the challenge, the FBI came to the island to train the police force in the use of submachine and machine gun, smoke, all these things that have been trained in World War One, the insular police in Puerto Rico is training on them, right? Mm. So they become, it is a time which the insular police in Puerto Rico is so militarized that they look like the police or the militaries in Central America.
Well, I was going to say, how do they avoid them being, you know, accumulating that same hatred that you see for the Somozan military or Somozan police?
Because to begin with, you have the 65th Infantry now, right?
Mm-hmm.
That most of the population look at it with admiration. Mm-hmm. It's Puerto Ricans in U.S. Army uniform. They are in every parade. Mm-hmm. They conduct all kinds of services. They're like in every communal activity, like festival and whatnot. They're there. Mm-hmm. They play. They're really involved. There's also the Puerto Rican National Guard that is starting to get not just the old elite, which are found in the 65th, but the new emerging elites, and it's becoming like it's becoming a real liberal and progressive body, right? You have what it would be the National Guard, and it's endemic, it's organic to the island. So it's the 65th, but it's more identified
with the regular army,
with the regular army and with the United States. The National Guard is more local, but at the same time, the two of them are accepted. They don't have to be involved in this because the police has it well at hand. And what happened is that the nationalists, they overplayed their hand over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean by this, whenever the police overplay their hand, the nationalists would get a lot of support.
Right.
All the rioters and their meetings, more people would come. How could you do this? Extrajudicial killings? Are you killing me? Are you kidding me? The police are arresting people and they said that they tried to escape while in custody and they were shot inside of a cell? So whenever this happens and the nationalists get a lot of support, they think, oh, it's my time to strike now. Now that they have the support, there's going to be a general rebellion. But no, they respond in kind, or sometimes they respond with even more violently, and the people, the support disappears.
Right.
And then comes in Muñoz Marín that's seeing this back and forth, and after the assassination of the American chief of police, retaliation later at the city of Ponce, the massacre of Ponce, and then the retaliation by the nationalists against trying to assassinate the governor, the American governor, that he was really hated and had to be removed.
Yeah, you mentioned that there is a switch. FDR personally intervenes to change the governor.
Yeah.
And so it shows that there is a presidential hand in all of this.
Oh, no, definitely.
Yeah.
And but there's the thing that when they tried to assassinate the governor, everyone hated the governor. They missed. The nationalists missed badly, and everyone who died that day were including a Puerto Rican Coronel from the National Guard were people who were beloved by most of the Puerto Ricans. Here comes Muñoz Marin and say, this is pointless.
Yeah.
Only Puerto Ricans are dying. We need to stop this. I regret the loss of life of Puerto Rico on both sides. And right. That's when people, when Luis Muñoz Marin was at the end of his career, it looked like he was the end of his career.
Yeah.
He understood, yeah, when the police strikes, the population support the nationalists. When the nationalists strike, the population withdraw their support, and they say, no, Puerto Rican don't want Puerto Rican killing Puerto Ricans. Mm-hmm. And he comes with this series of statements, his political career revives, and he's the one who's going to end up leading Puerto Rico.
You know, we're still on the subject of talking about the independence effort and the responses in Puerto Rico. What's going on in Washington? You know, do we see any kind of contradictory or complementary efforts to deal with the islands on these?
Well,
in Washington?
All of this has happened within the context of the Great Depression, which affected Puerto Rico before the U.S. mainland.
Absolutely.
Right? And as soon as FDR becomes president, he gets really worried that, and the military is worried, things are so bad in Puerto Rico right now. Economically, hunger is widespread, is worse than we ever seen, that they decide we need to fix this because there is a war coming.
Right.
And what happened in 1898, in which the population sided with the invaders, if the Germans or any other European or the Japanese invade, and there's this thought about the Japanese invading, they're going to side with them because things are bad. So he decides to stabilize things in Puerto Rico, and that's why he ends up sending Rexford Tugwell to Puerto Rico, one of the ideologues of the New Deal, to bring the New Deal in force and more to Puerto Rico.
He creates a Puerto Rican civilian conservation corps, more infrastructure on the island. What's going on with the 65th Infantry, though?
Well, the 65th, as soon as it's being brought up to full strength, at the same time that the New Deal comes to Puerto Rico, the military is also investing millions and millions of dollars, creating all types of air, army, and naval bases, eventually getting ready in case there is a war. What are we going to do? Where do we face it? Puerto Rico become the center of hemispheric defense. And FDR starts talking about Puerto Rico being the tip of our spearhead and where we're going to meet any European or Eastern-born aggression anywhere. In the Americas, and the 65th is brought up to strength as usual. As soon as they announce that they're recruiting, all the veterans come back and they have to line up. And the last 1,000, 2,000, so like, sorry, we have everyone we want. And they immediately send them again, as usual, Panama, but then the southern U.S. and everywhere they go is celebrated in Puerto Rico. It's like they cannot keep a secret. Everyone knows where the 65th is. And they receive all kind of training throughout the war. Amphibious training, infiltration, jungle, chemical training, all kinds of training. Because the military is like, we had to move them, but we don't have to deploy them in a theater of war.
Right.
They eventually are going to be in a few firefights. But it's not that they're participating in a battle. It's
is that the 65th itself, or were those members of the National Guard?
The 65th.
Really?
It is the 65th. Okay. So when the war ended, they sustained very few casualties.
Right. But
very few, especially combat casualties. You know, people die in training. People die. They get sick. But the casualties are minimal. They have received all this training. They have been living together, and they have been training since 1939 at least.
Wow.
And it's when they returned to Puerto Rico in 1945, they're so cohesive, so well trained, and the war they fought, it wasn't such a horrible war because they took part in a few firefights. They were in campaigns, but they were not in the front because they were not trusted or wanted. So their experience of the war was, I traveled, I trained, came back. Wow, it was an awesome war.
Wow. Well, it's just such a disparity in comparison of the treatment given other minority segregated units. I'm not just thinking about African-American units, but Japanese-Americans as well. There has to be some kind of really deep-seated, deep-rooted racial animus within the military establishment towards Puerto Rico. I can't get it. I can't wrap my head around it.
Well, that's part of it. And one of the interesting thing is that the 65th was the white Puerto Ricans regiment. Yeah. Everyone in the 65th of Korea was white. They had to be white.
Mm-hmm.
So to the point that when the United States is looking, the United States is looking for troops to garrison the French, Dutch, and British Caribbean so they can free up those troops and they can fight, right? The French and the Dutch, they say, mm-hmm. okay, you can bring some troops so we can send our troops to defend or whatever we have left to defend. And the Americans say, okay, yeah, but I'm going to send you some color regiments. And the color probably say, no,
yeah.
we don't want, you don't understand, that is going to alter the racial harmony that we have created
yeah.
here. And the United States say, okay, we're going to send you Puerto Ricans. And the correspondence between yeah. The different diplomats is incredible. They say, no, we don't want Puerto Rican either. You don't understand, Puerto Ricans are black. And the Department of War says, and the Department of State, no, we're sending you white Puerto Ricans who are bilingual and speak English. They will know, your people will know the difference. They're going to think they're white troops.
Wow.
So that's why they don't send the 65th, right? But they, the people, the Puerto Ricans from the National Guard that get to be deployed in the Caribbean, about maybe half of, maybe close to half or 40% of the American troops deployed in the Caribbean are white or white passing Puerto Ricans to assuage to assuage the worries of the Dutch, the French, and the British of bringing armed color men into their
colonies. Yeah,
yeah.
What about the Puerto Rican civilian population? How are they dealing with the war? How are they supporting the Second World War?
This is really interesting, right? The war is doing so much for Puerto Rico. The war project, when the United States starts to create or to turn Puerto Rico into an unsinkable battleship, which is how they conceive it, an unsinkable battleship, they couldn't spare continental manpower. Mm-hmm. So they started retraining Puerto Rican from the agrarian sector and in modern building industry techniques, right? And so for the Puerto Rican, they see the New Deal coming to the island, the economy getting better, roads being built, like telephone line, telegraph, is incredible. We call it a century of development in 10 years, right? To make Puerto Rico that unsinkable battleship that has to be linked to the point that one of our main highways to this day is called the military road or the military to this day. That's how I grew up calling it, the military, right? And not only that, but people who used to work in some of the lowest sector of the agricultural sector are now being trained to become industrial workers. And they're getting paid very well by the military. And these are about 40,000 to 60,000 Puerto Rican from peasant to industrial workers.
It's a big demographic shift.
It is an incredible demographic, right? And it's not only touching them directly, but it's like the whole economy. This period that historian Bolívar Fresneda has studied in terms of counting the beans, he say, wow, this is an era in Puerto Rico, a period in which we have a full military economy. And that is a lot to say because Puerto Rico had always been a military colony to the point that when the Americans invaded, between 25%, 30% of the budget, the colonial administration budget, was for the military. When have you heard about 25, 30% of your budget for assigned to military matters, right? So in an island that had always been a military bastion first and everything else came second, that a historian say, wow, at this period we have a full military economy. We don't have military industries, but making Puerto Rico that point of the state in hemispheric defense and then thinking, okay, the English are going to fall. Where do we house them? Okay, Puerto Rico. That's where the British government in the exile and the British forces in the exile are going to be housed so we can continue the fight from here, right? So that changed Puerto Rico that changed Puerto Rico drastically. And if on top of that you add that the soldiers are staying in Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. are basically not going anywhere, or yeah. deploy for a few months in nearby Caribbean island that they can continue, so there's no basically no Puerto Rican casualties,
yeah.
and the soldiers are getting, even Puerto Rican soldiers who train in Puerto Rico and never left the island, they get overseas pay.
Oh my goodness, wow.
And because they're overseas.
Yeah.
So, and they don't have no use for that money. They are stationed in bases, so they send all their money to their dependents. Hmm. So the from the point of economic point of view and what it does for Puerto Rico, yeah, there was a lot of support for the boys. Mm-hmm. They call it supporting the boys, a group of women, not just the elite women mm-hmm. doing their civic duties, but women from the working class, these communities doing what they can to support our boys.
Hmm. So mirroring what's happening in the United States in many ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we move ahead and you cast the Korean War. We're nearing the end of your book. You cast the Korean War as the defining moment in Puerto Rico's transformation from dependency into Commonwealth status. Is that due to the first combat deployment of the 65th, or are there other factors that play into that?
The deployment of the 65th plays a big factor here, and it's symbolically.
Yeah.
The newspapers in Puerto Rico, what I call the patriarchs in Puerto Rico and the opinion makers,
yeah.
They'll write how proud we should be that we've been found fit enough mm-hmm. to stop communist aggression and made the world safe for our democracies again, that this is it. Look at this. We're on the front lines. Fighting under the flag of the United Nations mm-hmm. in the middle of a decolonization project, mm-hmm. Right? You know that we know the former empires, many other colonies, they're on their way to independence or to fight for independence or to obtain independence politically, mm-hmm. right? And in Puerto Rico, they take these narratives too. They say, wow, yeah, we're fighting under the flag of the United States, but more so under the flag of the United Nations, mm-hmm. we're finding a third way, a Pacific way, a way of having our own democratic revolution. And these boys, these men,
mm-hmm.
they're going to prove it. That's why Puerto Rico became such a total war for Puerto Rico. And as you look at the press in Puerto Rico, the first 10, 12, 14 pages, every single day of the war, they're dedicated to the Puerto Rican soldier mm-hmm. in Korea.
Oh, sure, sure. But then how do you reconcile that with, you know, actions like the assassination attempt at Blair House that's happening? You know, Puerto Rican separatists are targeting Harry Truman and then building this reputation for the island. Again, going back to this America's Ireland kind of view.
Well, that's when, this is really interesting, right? World War II ends, and Puerto Rico, its economy has been linked, fused to the military and to federal transfers in a way that it had never been.
Mm-hmm.
And Puerto Rico has undergone this incredible transformation. And leaders like Muñoz Marín that have been thinking about independence, they start to realize, well, I depend on this type of economy.
Mm-hmm.
But more so, he had plans to transform even more
mm-hmm.
society in Puerto Rico. And in 1944, when he was president of the Senate, when he first heard about the GI Bill,
mm-hmm.
he thought, this is it. These are the people who are going to transform. He had studied the GI Bill. He knew that many of the Puerto Rican Serbs would not qualify because they didn't have high school.
Mm-hmm.
But then he got, this I found in his, what it would be our presidential library, the Fundación Muñoz Marín.
Mm-hmm.
I found all kinds of laws and passed in California, Maine, by their state legislatures. So their own soldiers, when they returned and didn't have high school, to put them on the path toward high school so they could go. So Luis Muñoz Marín, from the legislature in Puerto Rico, He started this, and he started to pass the same laws. So when the Puerto Rican soldiers started to return or were demobilized, they would be basically remobilized by the Puerto Rican colonial state. Mm-hmm. So they would finish high school, go to vocational school, and eventually to the University of Puerto Rico. And to put it this way, the GI Bill was used by perhaps 48% of the World War II GIs, right?
Right.
In Puerto Rico, it was close to 97%. And wow. It was because the state... And those Puerto Ricans who didn't use it because they moved here and they didn't have a state behind them, interested, invested in them becoming the professionals and know-how and providing the know-how and becoming the people who will lead Puerto Rico into a new modern era. Mm-hmm. In Puerto Rico, Muñoz Marín understood that in 1944 and he started working like Puerto Rican unit would come piecemeal and right. They would be the functionaries of the state waiting for them to fill out all the paperwork. No benefit will go unclaimed. No soldier was going back into the fields. No, you're going to finish high school. And this, because of the need to train the soldier and the funding that the Department of Education is providing as well, they decided to create not only the University of Puerto Rico expanded, but the vocational schools that I grew up next to, I didn't know his story, is based on that. They had to come and be trained on a task if they don't want to go to the university, right? And the public education system balloons too to house the soldier. So It is this participation, how integral the Puerto Rican World War II veteran is for transforming Puerto Rico, that Muñoz Marín said, independence will have to wait. Let's find something in between. And when he started conceiving this idea, the final idea is Public Law 600, in which Puerto Rico is going to find a different path. Autonomy, but within the United States. No one called it at the moment a reformed colonial state, but that's what it was. A colonial state with a lot of autonomy for internal matters. Mm-hmm. So to make the long story short, the nationalists, when they resort to insurrection and they attempt to assassinate Truman, is to stop this process.
Yeah.
But what happens? There's an insurrection in Puerto Rico in 1950. They actually waited. The nationalists, the way they look at this matter, we are never going to win insurrection if the 65th is here. Uh-huh. The 65th is sent to Korea. Now, insurrection happens. The National Guard and the police in Puerto Rico were more than enough to suppress it with very limited casualties. And in effect, it helped create the Commonwealth, because they were trying to stop it from becoming a reality. Mm-hmm. But the guy who's going to be in charge of the Commonwealth is the one who suppresses it, right? So it kind of, if American interests have their doubt that Puerto Rico will not descend to chaos, the way they handle this proved to American decision maker, no, they got it, so I support this. And actually, it made it impossible for any Puerto Rican to oppose Public Law 600. The nationalist insurrection. So in many ways, they helped to create it by trying to stop it, right? This is the, they hope, they didn't think that they would win, but they thought that if they withdrew to the mountains, they could hold on long enough for the world to take a look at them and intervene. But what happened is that they didn't last that long, that when they tried to murder Muñoz Marín, who have been elected governor, the picture the worst is dead people in front of the Fortaleza House in Puerto Rico and the United Nations flag riddled with bullets shot by the nationalists. So they lost the public opinion. They legitimized Muñoz Marín. They showed him as viable as Puerto Rico, the new reformed colonial state, being a viable thing. And that was their last shot. That was their last show. It was, they lost on every front. So now the thing is, how do we sell the war? And Muñoz Marín starts saying, well, look at our men. They were peasants. They were turned to soldiers. They're fighting for Puerto Rico because that is their duty as Puerto Ricans to protect the United States and the war. We're fighting for the war. And you know what happened? The stations, in the recruiting station in Puerto Rico, always had people lining up waiting because they wanted to fight, not just to fight, they wanted to be in that regiment that was fighting for Puerto Rico and the world. And that cemented the deal. And they became the embodiment of the Commonwealth formula. Mm. Not here, not there, not X, nor Y. We are the two of them. Mm-hmm. We can house these two identities.
Amazing.
That was it.
Where does Puerto Rico go from here? I mean, that's a loaded question, but what I'm wondering is, how should Americans and Puerto Ricans today, 60, 70 years later, reconcile the island's relationship with civic military institutions and the desire for a more amenable status?
Well, that is an interesting question. When Puerto Rico finds itself in an interesting position, which the annexionist movement or pro-State of the Union movement keeps growing, mm-hmm. despite the leadership of the PNP party that have never been able to handle the question of cultural identity and national identity. To them, that sounds anti-American. Mm-hmm. So that's what I say. Despite the leadership of the PNP that wants statehood, the statehood movement continues to grow, mm-hmm. right? But on the other hand, there's about 50% of Puerto Rican who would be, okay, let's stay the way we are. Mm-hmm. But with a few newer arrangements, kind of like reforming the colony.
Certainly somewhere. Before this time last year, they would be saying that.
Yeah, you mean before...
Before Maria.
And I think that because of Maria, the movement towards becoming a state of the union is going to become even stronger. Mm-hmm. I know that... this is a delicate question, but I know that if we only look at the Continental Press, it looks like the federal government failed at every level. Mm-hmm. But that opinion is not, it's shared by most of Puerto Rican academia in Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. by the opposition parties or the parties that, the statehooders are mm-hmm. in power now. So the opposition is anti-statehood. So that's their line too. But a lot of Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico, they don't share that opinion, even with all the data. And in times of crisis, and Puerto Rican history shows this, in times of crisis like this, mm-hmm. the annexionist movement grows.
Right.
It doesn't shrink. Hmm. So I think, and I know it's counterintuitive because of having a president throwing paper towels and insisting there's only 69 or 67 dead, or Puerto Rican are messing this up.
Well, I see a lot of that as reflective of actually the general ignorance that many Americans have towards Puerto Rico. I'm not going to pin it on him specifically.
No, definitely.
Yeah.
But I mean, since he represents, he's the head of the federal government,
the ugly one would expect
he's doing, the president actually said this, did that? You would expect more Puerto Ricans to be so deeply offended mm-hmm. that they would want nothing to do with the United States.
Right.
But on the other hand, it is, Trump is just a man. He's just another president. The mm-hmm. federal institution, and this is where I go back to the army, the federal institution in Puerto Rico are well respected, mm-hmm. and including, I mean, the postal workers, all the federal institutions that you have in the United States.
Everybody except the Navy.
Exactly. And now even the Navy is starting to get a lot of Puerto Ricans. But even I went to exercises in Vieques when Vieques was still part of the U.S. Naval installations. Mm-hmm. And as part of our training, they would come and tell us, well, you have be mindful because the locals are anti-military, and I thought, well, that's okay. I've never been there. Mm-hmm. That's going to be weird. But we were going everywhere throughout the island, right? But we had the patches that identify us as Army Reserve in Puerto Rico, and people would flock to us.
Yeah.
Because the Navy is not the Army, and the Army Reserve, a company full of Puerto Ricans, wasn't even the U.S. Army. It was the Puerto Rican Army.
Right.
So people were gonna even give us like free drinks and food. But the Navy, that was another thing, right?
Harry, thanks for joining with me today. I mean, God, it's always great to chat with you. As you know,
We have a few closing questions we'd like to ask at the end of our interviews. First, what are you reading or watching that you would like to share with our listeners?
Oh, wow. I don't know if I should do that. I'm watching so much Netflix these days.
Oh, wow. I mean, let's keep it professional. Yeah.
No. Well, lately I've been watching a lot of films about colonial soldiers. Mm-hmm. I think this one's called L'Indigène. About
Indigène, the Blades of Glory, yeah.
Exactly. I like the first part, which is really into the story. They try to recreate a Saving Private Ryan kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting. I've also been watching films that their names I can't remember about the Korean War producing Korea. Mm-hmm. And again, they follow exactly the same pattern I described before.
Yeah.
That they have so much technology to recreate great battles that they start with a great story and then they give you gratuitous battle scenes that they don't really fit into the narrative. But the stories are good, and in many ways I can see how they relate to the stories the history I've been trying to weave together here.
Sure. Well, what about reading? Are you reading anything of note that you'd like to share? Or
oh wow, you got me kind of like in well, recently, and this is interesting because you know, I write about Puerto Rico and I teach about Puerto Rico, and it's like Puerto Rico is never enough. If you're a Cubanist, you can write about the most obscure thing in Cuba and everyone wants to publish it.
Yeah.
Right? But if you write about Puerto Rico, you have to be comparative. So I've been reading this one in particular, To the Line of Fire, Mexican Texans and World War One. And
Jose Ramirez, I know this book. Yeah.
And it is an excellent book. And when I read it, I thought, wow, that's my history of the 65th Infantry.
Yeah. The book's about the Tejanos in the First World War, and it's such an interesting perspective.
Tejanos, Californios, which were, I mean, sometimes we think about the Latino experience, and we forget that Latinos come in all flavors.
Yeah.
So, also, because I do the Empire, Making Moros is something that I revisit, because the way the American officer became aficionado or amateur anthropologist trying to understand their new subjects and or the people they were fighting against. Mm-hmm. I think this book is amazing.
The book is Michael C. Hawkins, Making Moros, The Imperial Historicism and American Military Rule in the Philippines Muslim South. That's a great book. I have to get a copy of that myself.
No, it is an amazing book, and it gives a lot of perspective, especially in my introduction, on how to understand how this special relationship between the peasantry and the army develops. Because eventually in this book, what he claimed is that the Moros and the U.S. Army developed such a close relationship of respect because they have been killing each other, and the Americans came to see the Moros as, wow, these people can fight.
Yeah.
Not like the Northern Filipinos who can hold a rifle right.
That's martial racist doctrine, straight out of the British in India and dropped into the Philippines.
Exactly.
Wow. Harry, second question, what future projects should we be on the watch for from you?
Well, remember I told you that this started the 65th, and then I went and got this whole long durée to study formations, social formation and cultural formation in Puerto Rican history through the military lens. Well, I'm revisiting, and I have been revisiting the work that I did at Temple, and now I'm going to write have a contract to finish a book on the experience of the Puerto Ricans in Korea, only Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I have conceived the new work is that it takes on where this book ends, but it's an in-depth analysis of what happened in that war. So you're going to The book is going to include the demographics of the soldier, social and cultural study of who they are and what they're doing, the politics, the battles, the trial they go through, including the mass court-martial, and eventually the last chapter that I call the return is the repatriation of Puerto Rican prisoners of war, the wounded, and how they came to symbolize the sacrifice that Puerto Rico, the Puerto Ricans made, and not just for Puerto Rico, but for the communities in the Eastern Seaboard, the Puerto Rican community in the Eastern Seaboard, which are going from colonias to full communities. And in these Eastern Seaboard cities, there's this ugly question, which is called the Puerto Rican question. What do we do with them? And then this community, the returning prisoners of war and the soldier who get enough points to come back and the wounded, they became a way for this community to engage in politics of respectability and to claim and to make a claim of belonging in those cities. At the same time that they're being used in Puerto Rico as we earn this new status. And that's what the book is, but it includes the battles, the deployment, letters, and the cultural and the cultural, political, and social aspect of the war.
Great. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that, Harry. I really am. And many thanks again for joining us, Harry. Really, really appreciated having you join us.
Thanks so much for the invitation. I'm looking forward to keep chatting with you about this topic. It's always a pleasure to have long conversations with you.
That's great. And for all of our and to all of our listeners, this is Bob Wintermute with New Books in Military History, thanking you for listening.